This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick, The Mystical Positivist. Joining me in the following interview is my co-host, Dr. Robert Schmidt. Rob is the director of Tayu Meditation Center and founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol, California. This week we present a pre-recorded interview with Rose Volkhausen, Vijaya Fedorchak, and Karuna Fedorchak on the topic of spiritual lineage and how to embody lineage as disciples of a teacher no longer in his or her body. All three guests are disciples of spiritual teacher Lee Lozowick. Using the pen name Janet Rose, Rose Volkhausen is the author of Journey, From Political Activism to the Work. Vijaya Fedorchak is the author of Father and Son, The Indian Beggar King, Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar, and the American Master and Poet Lee Lozowick. Karuna Fedorchak is the author of Parenting, A Sacred Task.
Rose Volkhausen, Vijay Fedorchak, Karuna Fedorchak, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we're so glad to have you here. We normally begin by asking people about their spiritual background. With the three of you, that might be a little unwieldy to do it in our normal way, because that often ends up being the whole conversation in itself. But I still would like to begin by asking you each to talk a little bit about just some of the basics of your own story, just a sketch, and the story of your spiritual awakening or early childhood experiences that in retrospect seemed as if they were pointing in a direction that you later came to understand was the work that you came to do with your teacher Lee Lozowick. So Rose, why don't you begin?
Well, actually, I do have memories from very early that I've only recently begun to notice. I remember being perhaps 5 or 6 years old and going to my mother and saying, I just love my grandmother so much, I can't even hold it. And really, I think I was just beginning to feel a kind of love beyond the personal love. And a five-year-old had no idea how to understand that. So I called it love for my grandmother, but it was really love beyond the things that I could see and beyond the people even really that I knew, beginning of connecting to a love for the world and a feeling for world sorrow and world joy. And I remember having those off and on as I got a little older, and finally at age 13, I was really shy, and I never talked in front of people, and I was a bookworm. I read all the time, and one day I said, I need to give a talk at the Sunday school, and it wasn't even my Sunday school. It was my friend's, but I went there sometimes with her, and I said, I need to talk about love, and I went and asked the Sunday school teacher, can I give a talk on Sunday to the Sunday school children about love, and she said, yes, and so I studied the New Testament and Corinthians, and I gave a talk that really came from somewhere beyond myself. It was completely out of character of the person that I was and the kind of thing that I would do. And I think, again, I was being touched by something that was going to touch me again in much, much more unexpected ways as I went on. Even when I met my teacher, I rarely spoke in front of people for years. And now, since my teacher died, I find that I feel compelled to share the work that I did with my teacher and the investigation of the spiritual path with people on many different paths, because I feel our work with the spirit is so important in a world that's struggling. So this question of how a world beyond what we see and what we know on a material level, how that starts to break through into our lives. It's a very interesting question for me.
Thank you. Well, you make it interesting for the rest of us, too. Thank you for that beginning. So, Vijay, do you want to jump in or Karuna?
Well, I think I grew up bereft of any spiritual experience, really. I grew up in a housing project in Staten Island, New York, and went to Catholic grammar school. And, you know, groomed for success in a way, but really feeling lost. Just, you know, like pretending. And through high school, Catholic high school, and went to college, and, you know, ostensibly things were looking good. I mean, you know, I was on the road to becoming a city planner, which I did become for a couple of years, and but there was just something missing. And I'd never met anyone who seemed to understand that. I mean, really. And so when I was in college, one of my roommates suggested that we would talk at night, as you do sometimes in college, over various things. And he suggested I take this course called Silver Mind Control. And was meant to open up your psychic abilities. And I went there and was flabbergasted because I experienced some of that. And it just so happened that the person who taught the course, who was like a genius from what I hear, mentioned the name of Lee Loswick and said that he could do cases which were like psychic readings in between bites of a sandwich. And shortly thereafter, everybody split. Like the girlfriend that I had at the time, my best friend, he got married, and I was just kind of lost, not knowing, having any direction to go in. And I saw a poster up at the college at Rutgers University where I was going about Lee. And the teacher of the Silver Mind Control course had told me that he had gotten into something else and that he had had an awakening experience or something like that. And I checked it out and was completely surprised by what I found and continue to be surprised.
Got it. Thank you. Karina?
Well, thinking back to my early years, I'm glad you gave that cue because I guess I always had this feeling that something was missing for me. I mean, especially as I hit my kind of teen years and like that transition into the beginning of adulthood. And I don't know that I was really unique in that. I'm guessing that might be there for most of us and that it becomes buried, you know. But for me, it remained a vital thing, the sense that I was looking for something that would give like authentic meaning, like some kind of larger piece that I didn't feel that I had or that wasn't really in my environment. And although I had like, you know, a relatively happy home life and supportive parents and like that. But then it was when I was in college that I actually first met Vijay, and he had already made contact with our teacher, the man who became my teacher too, Lee Loswick. Really, though, at the point of meeting him and encountering the teaching that he was offering, it was really out of left field, and I had really nothing in my life to relate that to. But at the same time, it felt completely natural. I mean, it felt like the most natural thing in the world, you know. So it's a very interesting combination of experiences of just like, I didn't even know I was looking for this, and wow, it feels like, you know, a fish swimming in water. So that was my experience.
Thank you. I mean, that leads me to ask a follow-up, which is, did you have any other experience of religious or religious indoctrination or anything to contextualize what, I mean, I realize that Lee wouldn't fit into any of those boxes, but did you have anything in that regard?
I wouldn't say the family was devout, but my mom was a faithful churchgoer, and it was the Protestant church, which is pretty like, you know, whitewashed, or you know, at least that's how I would describe it. But I did go through a phase when I was, again, I'd probably say
preteen or teen when I became very fervent about Jesus for a short while. Mm. I think it was the only thing I had, like, you know, kind of a straw to hold on to. I remember praying and, you know, I don't think it had a whole lot of outer form other than going to church, as I usually did once a week, and maybe some kind of catechism classes or something like that. But no, there wasn't a lot, and I didn't even, you know, I guess it was the tail end there of the 60s, the whole 60s hippie era, but I was a little young for that, so I guess I was aware of the scene, like I was aware of the influences coming from the East, and Lee's style of teaching had a lot of, you know, a lot of East Indian influence, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Bowl tradition and other things, so yeah.
Okay, thank you. So I guess I'll invite you to talk, since we've been talking a little bit about your teacher, Lee Loswick, or you guys have been, that is to say, talking a little bit about Lee Loswick. I'm wondering if you could say more about what Lee, let's reserve what Lee means to you now, since he's no longer alive in the body. Let's leave that discussion for a little later, but what, when you first met him and for the years that you spent time with him in the body, what was that like for you? How did you experience him as a human being? How did you experience him as a teacher? Was there a separation between those two things, etc.?
Well, I can remember the first moment that I met Lee. I was invited by some friends to a gathering in Colorado, and where he was visiting, and he walked into the room. And I just remember looking into his eyes, these deep blue eyes, and it was different than anything I had ever experienced. He was just an ordinary man walking in, but looking into his eyes, I felt that I was looking directly into the field of reality, that his eyes were a doorway into reality that I knew existed, and I, in that instant, knew I had always been looking for, but I didn't know I was looking before that, in that way. I mean, I grew up Quaker, I grew up with silent meeting as a kind of meditation, but I wasn't looking for more so much consciously at that point. And his eyes were just this doorway, and I knew instantly, I can trust this man. This man could help me, and I can trust him. But I wasn't looking for a teacher. Hmm. So from that moment, I started participating in the study group that he had in Colorado and participating in the community that had formed around him. But I told him that I wasn't going to be a student and that I wasn't looking for a teacher, and I wasn't turning to him as my teacher, but I did feel he could help me. I was very clear, and I would say arrogant, but he was very patient and accepting, and he said, well, that's fine. And I said, is it okay if I work with this community? But you know, I'm going to leave after a while. This isn't my home. And that was almost 30 years ago. And he said, yes, that's fine. You can do good work here, and there's one spiritual path with many forms, and you'll find your way, whatever's your path, but if for now it's useful to work with us, then you work with us. And it took 2 years from then until I finally went to him and said, could I be a student? And I'm not sure I think he said yes, but it was kind of like ridiculous because it was so obvious by that time that I had been a student for a long time and I was the only one that couldn't admit it. So that was the beginning for me with Lee.
Thank you.
I was really in touch with a subtle form of suffering that, you know, I couldn't describe. I had no context within which to hold this. It was just like kind of life was like morbid. I mean, everybody you put on a happy face and, you know, you watch TV and like everything that was supposed to make you happy, like didn't really do it for me. And I kind of felt like a black sheep in a way. You know, I should be fulfilled by things that just did not seem fulfilling to me. And the Dharma, or spiritual teaching, when I first really started to hear it, was revelatory. I mean, it was like it was the first thing that really made sense to me. Like, just the fact, just by virtue of being separate, or believing oneself to be separate, there is suffering. I mean, like, that's, of course, you never assume that you're anything except a separate being. And then in studying the spiritual traditions, like, really was perplexed by this consideration of how one could be one with, and at the same time, a separate individual, ostensibly. And but then when you study the traditions and you like really get a sense of what transformation is about, and that there have been like real live human beings who have done that throughout history and not just the big famous ones, then like my encounter with Lee started making more sense. I stayed on the periphery for a while, which I think is not unwise these days, given that, you know, it's spiritual teaching is so accessible that it's easy to think, I think, that if you have a conceptual understanding of the Dharma or the teaching, that you really embody it. And, in relationship to Lee, I just little by little began to really trust this person. I mean, I felt really put through my paces. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that for all of us in a way. But in a way that, like, I really sensed was for my benefit. And that's irreplaceable to me. And, it's, you know, at this point, I realized that it is not about the personality of, you know, Lee. It's really about, like appreciation and being in relationship to everything on the spot. And that's a really challenging practice, you know, and so what we do, what we can in this life.
You mentioned something of the challenge, that it's very possible because of the accessibility of spiritual teachings that someone can have a conceptual understanding and construe that as a deeper or more profound understanding or embodiment of the teaching. As someone who is on the periphery, on what basis do you recognize in a teacher that they're doing more than simply operating from a conceptual understanding?
Well, I think you have to operate from more than a conceptual understanding. And little by little, you develop the ability to do that. You know, I read this quote, which I probably will skewer, of Rumi's, "Fool's gold exists because there is such a thing as real gold." And so, like, if you believe that the world basically is good, that the universe really, like, kind of knows what it's doing, and that there is a path, really, then you have this opening to trust a little bit. But then you test that against, you know, the student tests the teacher tests the student to see if, like, this is a good fit. And, Lee really threw me in it. I mean, I knew nothing of the teaching, but, like, within a year or so of my coming around, he asked me to run a study group with people who had been around a couple of years longer than me. And then he asked me to go to L.A. Then we moved to Arizona from the East Coast. And it was like, well, do I want to give up my city planning job? That, you know, like, my whole life has been, like, patterned to move in a certain direction. Do I want to shift course, you know, completely? I mean, that was the first challenge. And there was no... no demand. I mean, the demand was inner. Mm. Like, do I want to pursue this? Is this important enough that? And it was like, let's go. Let's see where this leads. And so Karuna came out, and there were 12 of us who came out to Arizona. And as they say, the rest is history for us, anyway.
Well, maybe you have a another way to describe that, the emergence of that history, Karina. So tell us what that was like for you.
Okay. I'm getting a little hazy on the original question. It was what attracted you to Lee? Was that kind of the gist?
Well, actually, no. It's more if you could just characterize your relationship with...
Yeah.
I mean, that can include things like how you imagined your relationship with Lee was like, and then how that may have changed over time. It's more like just an invitation to speak about how that evolved for you.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks. I think for me it was always, like, from the very first, it was all about a connection to Lee. Like, it was all about a personal connection, and assumedly one that was, you know, kind of bigger than this lifetime, perhaps. And I too was, it's interesting we're all echoing this, I too was cautious about jumping in, but at the same time, I think very early on, it was, you know, it was clearly a love affair. And so it was sort of like signing on the dotted line and then reading the small print later.
you needed a prenup.
No, just like, you know, in a, like somewhere in my heart, like I'm in, you know, mm-hmm. even though I then, which I would agree as well is smart. I just didn't like jump right in. And it was the era of kind of women's rights and women's lib. And I was like, I was all about that. I was I was just finishing college and, so I was cautious, you know, I was cautious about some of the forms that were, you know, that were being practiced in relationship to Lee, traditional forms, obviously, of like respect toward the teacher, but they were things that I really wanted to take my time to consider, and my experience was that Lee was very spacious about that. He didn't seem to be the least bit threatened and seemed to, in fact, support me to really, you know, to find my own way, and so I did gradually do that. Because as I mentioned already, I didn't have I had not much reference point for any for this domain of relationship to a teacher or a guru.
You hadn't been doing a lot of the reading of the books that were starting to become available at that time.
I hadn't after meeting Lee, then I began to be educated. In fact, he gave me a stack of things to read. Like he gave me a primer, you know, a set of books that would be a primer for me.
I've heard many of his students tell me that.
That's right. Yeah, and it was great.
Thing.
They were wonderful books, and it really, really served me well. But because I didn't have much reference point, I had this image. I remember I was nervous about meeting other students and being in situations with the rest of his, you know, students, because I had this idea that maybe they wore robes and kind of, you know, like walked like they were floating off the ground. So I was so relieved to meet people and find them very down to earth and funny and, you know, and just like ordinary people, except with the very big exception that they were in the company of, you know, of an authentic spiritual teacher, I would say.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, that stimulates me to ask a question then about Sangha. And of course, Sangha is this word that means community, and community, a spiritual community, a community of practice. And I'm wondering, since you've all been mentioning Sangha implicitly along the way here, and your relation, and touching a little bit upon your relationship to Sangha, maybe this is a good place to talk about that aspect of being in the company of your teacher. So, and maybe Karina, why don't you begin, because you sort of instigated this question.
Yeah, the Sangha. Well, I think in the same way there was a kind of meeting and a heart connection with the other people in Lee's company when I first came around, but also at the time the Sangha was very young, and I don't know if I was alone in this, but I personally was also on another level very critical of how people were. You know, I felt people were childish or, you know, immature, and you know, I had judgments and opinions mm-hmm. even while I was getting to know people and falling in with them, and I guess that it it was clear that in engaging relationship with Lee, it wasn't just him, it was also the kind of the setting around him, you know. So it was kind of all, it was a package deal.
So in other words, it wasn't just the teacher and the relationship with the teacher, but the context that arose around the teacher and the community of people that was material to the challenge or the practice that you were engaged in.
Yes, and in later years, Lee would, in his inimitable way of expressing things, he'd say, "Love me, love my dog."
I never heard him say that one. That's good.
We did.
I'm sure you did.
Yes. Well, yeah, that's, you know, it's really a mixed bag with the Sangha, because, like, working in a group is just such an advantage. But it's not the kind of advantage that you would, like, you know, wish for in a way.
Or seek out.
Yeah, hardly. I mean, you know, because you're thrown together in, like, this kind of tumbler where you're just kind of rubbing up against other people. But that is so useful for your own spiritual development. You know, you get things that might remain unearthed get exposed for you to, like, look at and work with. In a way that wouldn't otherwise if you were just kind of meditating in your room.
Right, so...
And studying the teaching out of a book.
Right, right. So it's like you're living near or adjacent to among people, right? And also, and or depending on the circumstance, that may be more or less true at different times, I suppose. I don't know. But also you're engaging in projects with these people, right? And it's projects that have deliverables, I assume. So when there are projects that have deliverables and there are expectations about that...
See, like one of my earliest, except the first household that I lived in back in those days, before we moved to Arizona, there were, you know, I was invited, in quotes, to live in a household, mm-hmm. which, you know, was like really notable experience. But like the two guys lived in this room downstairs and they put up a divider between them, and one of them would just like kind of talk to himself like a lot, and the guy on the other side of the divider like was in tears one day, like, you know, please stop, you know, please stop. I mean, anyway, yeah, the deliverables. I'll just mention a few projects that I had the great fortune of being involved in, but mm-hmm. that were like really challenges and difficult in some ways, but also extremely useful in my own work. You know, as I mentioned, he asked me one day if I wanted to go to Los Angeles in the early 80s and run a group. I'd never even thought about anything like that. Like, it just kind of came from nothing. But, like, what a project that was. There were trips to India where a large group of people would go and, you know, like, really mix it up, like, spend time going to different holy sites with Lee. And there were businesses like a glass case business. Oh, my God. You know, different people had different roles in constructing glass cases, but like...
Did you like display cases or something
that? You know, we went to Arizona and we're like penniless and, you know, we need to support ourselves. Like, what a mm-hmm. concept. At the same time as doing spiritual work. And one of the guys in the group, Jeff Warb, like just comes back one day all excited because he sees these India Kachina dolls like in stores, and there are a few glass cases that you know are displayed in these things, and he figures out that he can rip off, I mean he figures out that he how he can like you know do the same kind of thing. That was a joke. But you know, so we start making these things, and all of a sudden there's this like, you know, big business where we're driving all around the west part of the country delivering cases for different kind of collectibles. And but you know, some people are in sales, some people are putting the cases together and like that. But you see, one of my jobs was to like seal the bases, like to stain them and like to do this thing. But one day I was out on the road and I came back and somebody else was in my position. He, you know, like Lee told, we need somebody, this work needed to be done. I wasn't around. Somebody else but to me, I just needed like some security, some ground to kind of hold on to. And the tension of like not feeling kind of groundless was, I broke down into tears. I mean, I remember this. And the guy who was doing it was just happily, like, just kind of staining the bases and stuff. And Lee just came down to the place where this was happening and just kind of stood with me. And, you know, the work is in very simple things, in very small things in our lives. We have the opportunity to practice. And I have the opportunity to practice, like, non-identification and just kind of letting go. You know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guests Rose Volkhausen, Vijaya Fedorshak, and Karuna Fedorshak on the topic of spiritual lineage and how to embody lineage as disciples of a teacher no longer in his or her body. All three guests are disciples of the spiritual teacher Lee Lazowick.
Well, I was thinking about the phrase in the Eastern scriptures that there are the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And for me, the Sangha is definitely a precious jewel, and at the same time, it's a very challenging jewel. So I have felt tremendously supported and nourished by relationship with other people on the path and the chance to practice together, and that's really the foundation of my life. And at the same time, living closely with human beings is not easy. So in any marriage, in any friendship, in any long-term work relationship as co-workers, we come up against our human weaknesses and also the inspiration of the human being. And that has been my experience of Sangha, that I've been living on an ashram as part of Lee's community for over 20 years. And from the first day that I moved on to the ashram, that was home. There was, by that time, I was clear that I was a student, and I never wanted to go back to having a house of my own, living by myself, having a kind of more more typical American lifestyle. I was really deeply fed by living on the ashram, living with other people, and at the same time, it's profound confrontation to live day by day by day with other people, to parent children, to be parent with children and raising the children with other parents. And for Lee, community life, the life of family, the life with children is a very important part of our spiritual practice. So children and families are not an aside the way they might be in some ashrams that are more focused on adult life. The practice of being with children is a very important part of our spiritual practice. But parenting children with other parents closely is not easy, because we all have opinions about the children, and we all have opinions about each other, and we were all wounded as children, so we're all hoping there can be a perfect parent somewhere, and we project both that yearning for the perfect parent and all the weaknesses of our own parents onto everybody around us, except ourselves, and then unconsciously toward ourselves also. And the result is, it's really deep work to share the parenting of children. And there was no question that the parent was responsible for their own child. We weren't co-parenting in such a way that all the children belonged to all the adults, but we were deeply sharing responsibility for the children. And I worked closely in the homeschool program with children on our ashram, which I loved. But again, it's very deep work with each other. And I think it's like a long-term marriage. You pay very deeply in going through the confrontations, and what you build is something incomparable. There is nothing that can compare to what's produced by a long-term marriage, a long-term friendship, and long-term relationship with the Sangha, and the chance to share spiritual practice basically over a lifetime to go deeper and deeper into practice together.
Thank you. There's a couple of questions for me that come out of this, but the first I want to turn our attention to is all three of you in different ways have used the term work, has produced work. Now, for many people who hear about spiritual practice, you know, they think, well, practice is like I sit and meditate, something like that. And yet, I've heard very clearly from each of you that although these practices may be there to support work, that there's a deeper work going on. So I'd invite each of you to speak for a second of, you know, what is it? What does it mean to work? You know, so you see something in this friction with other people. You see the yearning, and you see the disconnect between your wounds and your hopes and aspirations and the reality of the moment. What constitutes work in that coming together of all those factors?
Well, Lee said to us many times that one of our deepest practices was simply kindness, generosity, and compassion. So we could meditate for hours, but if that doesn't have a result in the world we live in of being more kind, more generous, more compassionate, then whatever we are doing in meditation is not effectively connecting with a living practice. And my experience is that a real meditation practice does have results in the world. But that work of kindness, generosity, and compassion, that's where a kind of spiritual alchemy goes on within us. So for me, spiritual work essentially involves the transformation of who I think I am into a being that was always already present, but I have forgotten that being. And so in one way, the work is to build a being, but in another way, the work is to remember a being that is already present, but buried by many, many layers of conditioning, of fear, of pride, anger, greed, lust. We have the layering of distortion of who we are is so deeply rooted, and it takes, in my experience, a daily willingness to confront how I am serving and loving the people around me and how I am damaging and even betraying the people that I love, and to be willing to really look deeply into that, that is work. And all of the spiritual practices are essentially to help us in that process of confrontation and transformation.
Got it. Thank you.
You know, listening to your question, what comes up for me is that in this moment, is that the work is about getting out of my own way and seeing what comes through. I think, like they say, that Lee would say in the early days, like, you're all already enlightened. Like, it's not a goal to attain. It, like, exists here in the present, but we're asleep. So what does that mean, we're asleep? I think that, you know, like, when we study this, we study it through mind. And, like, kind of what I've come to know, understand, believe, is that you know, what happens for me is, and I think for all of us, is like there's this mental chatter, this internal dialogue that's going on kind of constantly. But when I can, when that's, and it presumes that I am identified with this person, this psychic structure, this psychological person, this physical person, and that's all of that I am. And I'm about protecting that, like, you know, to, from birth to the grave. But when that is out of the way, when survival is not an issue, what comes through is like freedom. What comes through is like creation. To me, the work is about that. It's not about, you know, setting up how it's supposed to be. God only knows how it's supposed to be. But it has its own intelligence. And when that happens, it just is naturally about service to, like, the rest of humanity. And but what's in the way of that? So when we say, when I say work, or when you say work, to me, a lot of the nuts and bolts of it are about, like, observing myself. I mean, that's kind of a foundational kind of practice, like self-observation, like to see how I, you know, how I'm interfering with the process, with my assumptions, and you know, I think that that's, there's nothing wrong with the way that we are. This is just what it is to be a human being. So, like, actually, I think that as you start to look at yourself and see ways that you're self-referenced, and by virtue of that, like, kind of selfish, and really focus just on oneself, one begins to develop some remorse and some conscience about, like, what else is possible as a human being for yourself, and how you might serve in some way. And that's kind of tastier than just kind of being all about, like, yourself. So, I don't know, that's what occurs to me.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I would say that the work that is necessary in relationship to an authentic teacher and engaging with a transformational process is kind of about clearing the ground, or like doing basic housekeeping. You know, like, I think that we bring our baggage, you know, when we come to a real teacher, a real master, a genuine guide, and before we can really begin the process, we have to engage this basic work, and the presence of others also doing that work, I think facilitates that process, you know, and continues to be a barometer, I think, for us of like where we're really at. I think it would be easy for me to fool myself if I weren't in relationship with others. And
so it's a positive and negative feedback system.
Yeah,
is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think both ways. And you know, in our experience with our teacher Lee Lozowick, like what you know could be called group work, and we use this word work, kind of taking that term from George Gurdjieff, the Russian mystic who many of your listeners are probably familiar with. Group work was a really big part of you know Lee's way of working with students, and I think probably on some you know really basic level, it was energetically advantageous to him to have us all rubbing up against each other, because a whole lot of really basic work got you know exposed and addressed and done that he didn't really have to engage with, you know, and I was thinking too, there's a way in which that, you know, a realized being, an authentic teacher is like out of the game, you know, off the wheel, we could say. And so all the rest of us, that's not true of, and so there's a way in which in the company of the teacher, you're really kind of all in it together in the same boat. And I wouldn't say, like in our case, that Lee was could look like he was in that boat with us, but I think that in reality he really wasn't. So to be in relationship and working with one another was like, it was just the name of the game, you know.
It's interesting, with the other thread that occurred to me in an earlier phase of the conversation is an observation that I've had, because, you know, I've had the privilege of knowing the community for many, many years. In fact, my own arc of spiritual practice was never without the presence of the home community, and Lee Lazowick as my own teacher, Robert Innes's friend. One of the first events I remember was, I think when I met you, was a talk that Lee and Robert gave together at our house in Forestville. And so I've had a lot of exposure to the community and people visiting here, and, you know, over the years. And what's interesting that I've observed is I've watched the community mature in the same way that I've seen individuals mature. And it's a very distinct thing, and it's one of the few communities I know of that I can see the community as a whole evolved as an organism. And I say that because, you know, they're, you know, parallel with my own process. You know, I can see, have to remember annoyances and things like that in the early days that in later days don't appear in the same way. And it's been a very, very clear part of the work that I see Lee's work and all of your work was not just individual transformation, but it was transformation of a body of individuals working together. And I certainly invite any of you to speak to that, but that's an observation that it's always been a very strong thread for me.
One thing I have to mention is, like, the tremendous humor involved in the process, too. I just don't think that that real spiritual work can be going on if there's not a lot of humor. I mean, you know, it sounds like, oh, my God, why would you ever do this? And really, had I known what was looming ahead, I would, you know, I'm not sure I would have signed up, so to speak. But you just feel like you are, like, finding yourself, at least for me, just finding who I am. Like, you know, like really, though. Like, not just an artifice. But part of that is, like kind of losing who you think that you are, in a way. Lee would be so funny. Like, he would just, like, his teacher was Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar, who lived in Tiruvannamalai, and his teacher was Papa Ram Das in Anandashram. And Papa Ram Das used to say, "Here we laugh the ego away." And I don't know what to say. I mean, you know, Lee could be so irreverent that it was like, in India one time, I'm sitting next to him and eating, like, with our hands, as you do, and across the, you know, across the table, I mean, we're sitting at this, like, with a cloth table, and one of the guys who's with us, he is, what? How to describe this? I'm not sure what color he was. It was like kind of green, no, orange, gray. I mean, he was looking kind of pretty bad, just being in India and purifying, I guess. Like, things were oozing out of his pores, out of his face, and Lee just kind of leans over next to me and just says, "Jerry, want some enzymes?" And I don't know. All I could say is that I lost it. I mean, I was just like, and but that's the thing, is that, like, and in sitting with Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar sometime, his teacher, I don't know why, I was just, like, transported into an altered state, in a way, of just being completely out of my own way and free. We don't even realize how constricted we are. I mean, like, the paucity of self-observation is, like, you know, even while we know that, you know, how to describe practice, to actually practice, to act, you know, on a deeper and deeper level is, you know, where we're going. Where we're going, and sometimes everything's out of the way. And, you know, there were just in times in sitting with Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar. I don't know. Like, I'm one of those people who had Shakti experiences sometimes. I mean, I haven't had them for decades now. But at that point, like, all the blockages in my body were, like, so tight. And, like, I was just ecstatic sitting with him, just in his presence, Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar. And my arms would fly up. And, like, one time I'm on this ledge with this group of 10 guys that he took with him to India, and Lee just kind of, I mean, the people who are listening to this can't see this, but, I mean, Lee just kind of, with his hand, just kind of beckoned me forward a little bit, as if I was going to, like, fall off the ledge. He didn't want me to fall off the ledge, because you could lose yourself. You know, when you have these experiences, these moments of freedom. But moments of freedom are just pointing in a direction. They're not the end of the path. And sometimes people have those and assume that the path is completed. You know, it's just it's kind of to give you a taste of a direction to keep, you know, to understand more why you're practicing, what it's about.
This comment you made that you've seen the community grow as an organism reminds me that in the last months before Lee died, he spoke several times about the possibility of enlightened community. And I think that's a tremendously inspiring possibility. And what I understood from his discussion was that it's possible for a group, a community as a whole, to be living in a higher state of awareness than any of the individuals are actually living in. And that may sound paradoxical, but I think it's because human groups can either pull each other down, which is what happens when you have like a mass panic attack in a city, or human groups can pull each other up. And when a group has a deep practice together, it's possible for the best of each individual to get fed into a kind of higher state of awareness of the whole group. And so even though each individual within the community obviously has weaknesses, is not in a state of enlightenment, the community as a whole might be emanating and offering a state of awareness and of radiance that's beyond the individuals. And I think Lee's not the only one that's spoken about that possibility. Someone was just saying to us today that Thich Nhat Hanh had spoken about the possibility that the Sangha could become the teacher rather than an individual teacher for a school. And I've heard other teachers say something similar about the possibility of a practicing community. And I think in our time, that's a really inspiring direction. For me, it doesn't replace the need for and the importance of individual teachers. I think having authentic individual teachers on this planet is crucial, and that there will continue to be authentic teachers, and there will be continue to be false teachers, because where there's light, there's always shadow, there's always some distortion. So I think we always will have to discriminate between the real and the false teacher and the real and the false work of any community, but I do think that both are important, the individual teacher and the possibility of the community.
I was thinking, as you said that, an analogy which in part betrays my own scientific background, but it's the analogy of a hologram,
mm-hmm.
where when you take a hologram, to make a hologram, you reflect light off of an object, and then you record all of the complex interferences on a piece of film. And then when you reconstruct the hologram, you take the laser light and replay it through the film. And if you have the whole film there, then the image is reproduced very, very strongly. Whereas if you just have a piece of the film, you can cut away, you still get some part of the image, but its resolution is a little bit less. And I was actually reflecting on, I didn't put it in those terms, but it was interesting the last time I visited the ashram that we had a lot of different conversations with a lot of different people, and I felt like I was seeing very clear images and facets of Lee, which, when you put it all together, recreates in a sense, the power and the energy of his presence, and yet individually it wasn't that his power and presence wasn't there, but it wasn't the complete picture. And so, you know, different people, and I think this is probably a natural thing in the community, have different interpretations of what we should be doing, or is this right, is this inconsistent, and are we living up to the way we are, and everyone has a different voice. And I realized that's not a conflict, that's a feature, you know, and that's a feature of the different facets of Lee that's being recreated in its entirety. And it's interesting as we talk about this, because I see how a community that's worked closely with the teacher, each individual is critical to the recreation and the transmission forward in time of the work of that teacher, because they reflect something that only really gets completely reconstituted when everyone functions together as a community. Interesting. That's very helpful to hear you say that, because that kind of put something together for me about what I've been feeling with the community lately.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful description that you just gave. Thank you.
We need to take a short break at the hour. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Co-host Robert Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guests, Rose Volkhausen, Vijaya Fedorshak, and Karuna Fedorshak, on the topic of spiritual lineage and how to embody lineage as disciples of a teacher no longer in his or her body. All three guests are disciples of spiritual teacher Lee Lozowick. We will return to our conversation with Rose, Vijay, and Karuna after a short break.